This is number 0012, the Snuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Snuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and this is indeed the Stuff File program number 0012. And coming up, we have a full show as usual. We'll meet Stuart Stanyard, who is the creator of the Twilight Zone Archives and author of Dimensions Behind the Twilight Zone. You know, the show went on the air 50 years ago last month, and it's still popular. How do you explain for its success?
Twilight Zone really was in the forefront of fantasy and science fiction on television. And I think it's lasted for so long. Obviously, it's because of Rod Serling. That man had a great grand vision in creating a series that not only was fantasy and sci-fi oriented, but also dealt with the same human condition and citing the social constructs of civilization and urban alienation and fear and prejudice and the Cold War era that he had contributed to live television. I think it's lasted so long because it's just a very timeless piece of cinematic modern art.
Odile Rault is a British actress who runs a website called usemyaccent.com. that collects accents for actors to practice their accents.
For their sample, they can do whatever they like. You know, they can either just chat a little bit. A lot of them sort of just chat and introduce themselves. Or they can read a nursery rhyme or, you know, anything that they like. Just for the actor to be able to hear the type of voice they have.
We'll hear from Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation.
Tinting. Great for your hair. Not so great for your car windows. Hi, this is Steve Walsh, you know, your guy in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. You're going to want to stick around for my two-minute tirade. It's coming up later on, right here, on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
We have a check of the mailbag.
Incoming subspace signal.
Plus, Andrew Vizekas, the night sky guy, has another feature for us. The guest Slater on this edition of the Stuff File program, the person who told you it was 0012, is Carolyn Fee, the artistic director and co-founder of Altera Vitae Productions. It's a Montreal theater company that has a true heart. They produce works of theater that engage and service the community, and with each new production, the company partners itself with a valuable organization whose mandate is similar to themes that is in their current play. And by the way, their current play is called Bent. It's written by Martin Sherman and it's directed by Carolyn Fee. You can find information such as box office, tickets, where the show is performed. You'll find all that stuff on their website, and you'll find the link to their website on my website by going to peteranthonyholder.com and click on the Stuff File program button, look for show number 0012, and you'll find all the information for the show Bent. By the way, Caroline is a very, very busy lady. I'll explain that in a moment. But I want to mention the fact that she did the slate this week and she added production values to it. And this is rather unique because we don't usually have somebody who adds production values to our slate. And she did it with her sound guy, whose name is Dan Legault, and he's not even in the country. He's actually, as we speak, in Morocco. So she recorded it here in Montreal. He edited it in Morocco, and we have it in the show for you as the opening slate. I know a lot of production went into a little bit of information at the beginning of the show, but there you go. And I understand that Dan listens to the program as well. So a shout out to Dan, even though he's in Morocco right now. And thanks for helping Caroline put the slate together for this week's program. And now I said that Caroline's a very busy lady. I mentioned that she directed the show, Bent, which opened, by the way, on November the 5th and is currently running. Then right after that, she jumps into rehearsals as an actor in another play called P4W, by a local playwright, that local playwright being Julia Ainsworth, and it's about a woman in prison, and she plays a character who murdered her lover. And at the same time, while all that's happening, she continues to write blues music, and she has her own CD out called 100%, which can be purchased online at cdbaby.com/CarolynFee. And again, you'll find the link to that on my website at peteranthonyholder.com. Okay, we're going to get to the stuff in just a moment, but before we get to that, an important announcement pertaining to this program. The Stuff File program can now be heard on cyberstationusa.com. Check it out. Point your browser to cyberstationusa.com, click on it, bookmark it, remember it. And I want to thank the gang at cyberstationusa.com for picking up the show. Hopefully this will be a long and lasting relationship. Again, check out the website, cyberstationusa.com. Let's get to the stuff, shall we? We start off with a story that takes place in Beijing. As you know, they were the host of the recent Summer Games. Well, a Chinese collector of Olympic memorabilia will be putting some of his mementos on the auction block later this month, including a batch of 5,000 condoms given to competitors at the 2008 Beijing Games. The items, labeled with the Olympic movement's faster, higher, stronger motto, oh, that is just so wrong, are leftovers from the 100,000 condoms distributed for free to athletes at the Beijing Olympic Village. The entire lot of 5,000 must be purchased by one buyer at the Exceptional Auction of China Sport Collection on November 29th, with the bidding to begin at 5,000 yen, that's about $730 US, or about 1 yen per condom. Although anyone married should be interested for their personal use, some people will be too shy to bid for the condoms. That's what was quoted in the newspaper, the quote being attributed to an auctioneer. Other items up for sale include a torch autographed by Brazilian football legend Pelé and a medicine case from the 1936 Games. Condoms from the Beijing Games. Yes, faster, higher, stronger. That could also be the motto for Viagra. Sorry. Moving right along, we have a couple of stories dealing with people who don't know when it's appropriate to dial 911. The first one comes from Aloha, Oregon. A 20-year-old man who called 911 to get his fast food order straightened out has been told to pay a $300 fine. Washington County, Oregon sheriff's deputies said Rabin Roaf Osman called the emergency line to complain that a McDonald's in Aloha had left out a box of orange juice from his drive-through order. A restaurant employee later called 911 to report that Osman and others who were with him were blocking the lane, knocking on restaurant windows, and intimidating employees. Deputies tried to explain to Osman that refereeing such disputes is not what they do. They said he insisted that he had a legal right to call the police, and he was taken to jail. The Oregonian newspaper said Osman pleaded guilty recently to improper use of 911 and has been ordered to pay the fine. Meanwhile, in the same state, in Salem, Oregon, Oregon police have charged a man with drunken driving after he called 911 to report his marijuana was stolen, but the dispatcher couldn't understand him because he was vomiting while on the road. Marion County Sheriff's deputies say 21-year-old Calvin Hooter of Salem told dispatchers that someone had broken into his truck and stolen cash, a jacket, and a small amount of marijuana while he was at a tavern in Salem. He then called 911 again to complain that deputies had not arrived, but the dispatcher had trouble understanding Hoover because he was driving and stopping several times to vomit, to hurl, to distribute a Technicolor yawn. He was arrested on charges of driving under the influence of intoxicants. You know, I almost made him our idiot of the day, but he's not. We'll get to that later. Moving right along, when officials in Edison, New Jersey heard that the Exotica Expo was coming to the New Jersey Expo Center, they decided to block the event. The Township Council quickly passed an amendment to its zoning law to prohibit any shows or sale of sexually oriented products in gatherings of 100 or more people at any place located within 1,000 feet of a place of public worship, a school, a playground, hospital, or any child care center or an area zoned for residential use. There was a minor problem with that tactic. None of those existed within 1,000 feet of the expo center. So the show went on as scheduled. What morons. If you're going to enact a bill, make sure it stands up when you enact it. Really. Come on. No one had a measuring tape? Moving right along, we go to California. The California Highway Patrol says a man stole a car to make a court appearance on a previous auto theft charge. The patrol says 24-year-old Samuel Bochveroff of Oakland was arrested after he left his arraignment at the Valero County Courthouse on auto theft charges. He was booked into Solano County Jail on suspicion of auto theft and possession of stolen property. Authorities were looking for the stolen car after its tracking system alerted them about the theft. The car was stolen from Oakland. They say Bochveroff told officers his own car had been impounded and that he had no other way to get to his arraignment. I think the whole concept is lost on this poor fellow. No details about the previous theft charge were immediately available. Meanwhile, this is someone we talked about on the old radio program on several occasions. And now that she has her license, or is closer to getting her license, this story frightens me a little bit more. It's from Seoul, South Korea. A woman in South Korea who tried to pass the written exam for a driver's license with near daily attempts since April of 2005, has finally succeeded on her 950th time. The aspiring driver spent about 5,000 won, or about 4,200 US in application fees, but until now had failed to score the minimum 60 out of a possible 100 points needed to get behind the wheel for a driving test. Cha Sa-soon, who is 68 years of age, finally passed the written exam with a score of 60. This according to a police official at the driver's license agency in Jeonju, which is about 130 miles south of Seoul. Police say Cha took the test hundreds of times, but had no specific total. Meanwhile, local media said she took the test 950 times. Now she must pass a driving test before getting her license. She told the Korea Times newspaper she needed the license for her vegetable selling business. Wow. If she gets behind the road, she could be making vegetables, if you know what I mean. This is a scary thought. And you know, some people will do anything for a Rolex watch. They'll do too much, actually, for a Rolex watch. A Florida thief with a particular penchant for Rolex watches faces up to 25 years in prison. Leonardo Perez has pleaded guilty to charges he stole 8 gold Rolex Presidential Edition watches worth about $50,000 each over 4 months in 2007. The crime spree began just after Perez finished a 17-year sentence for, you guessed it, stealing Rolexes in South Florida. Some people just never learn. The 36-year-old Miami native is so loyal, he even has the Rolex logo tattooed on a forearm. Investigators say he's been able to glimpse and follow drivers wearing the watch from the other side of the road. Perez was supposed to be sentenced on Thursday of last week in Orange County, but the hearing was delayed. He primarily found victims out shopping, followed them home, and robbed them at gunpoint. Not a nice guy at all. That's kind of a Twilight Zone kind of thing, don't you think? That's a segue for you, boys and girls. You know, October marked the 50th anniversary of the first television airing of The Twilight Zone, so we thought we'd talk to someone who is a Twilight Zone collector and who is also the creator of the Twilight Zone Archives, the internet's number one Twilight Zone website. That person is author and illustrator Stuart Stanyard, who also wrote the unique behind-the-scenes book, Dimensions Behind the Twilight Zone. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me on your show today.
Thanks for being on with us. 50 years the show first went on the air, and we should mention another anniversary. If I'm not mistaken, it's 10 years that your website's been up. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's start in chronological order. Yeah, the Twilight Zone TV series first premiered on October 2nd, 1959. So this year marks its 50th anniversary. And in January of 1999, I started the nonprofit organization, the Twilight Zone Archives, and this year we celebrated our 10th year anniversary.
That's a show that clearly, since it's 50 years, there's a certain staying power with what that show represented. Why do you think it has such fans?
Well, you know, Twilight Zone really was in the forefront of fantasy and science fiction on television. And I think it's lasted for so long. There's a few different ways I could answer it, but obviously it's because of Rod Serling. That man had a great grand vision in creating a series that not only was fantasy and sci-fi oriented, but also dealt with the same human condition and citing the social constructs of civilization and urban alienation and fear and prejustice and the Cold War era that he had contributed to live television. I think it's lasted so long because it's really, it's just a very timeless piece of cinematic modern art, just the way it was created by those people who had years of experience working on those classic movies at the Grand MGM studios. So you had teams of different crew people and a lot of very, very well-known directors and composers. And so all across the board between the talents of Rod Serling scripts and a few other writers like Charles Beaumont and Richard Matheson, it was created very magically in an era when most of the television was very conformed, westerns and crime dramas and wait till your father gets home type of sitcoms.
Well, do you think part of the success of the show was the time period it was in? And by that I mean discussing some of the issues that the show brought up and the fact that it sort of taught a lesson about the human condition along the way. Do you think perhaps audiences today are a little too cynical for some of the messages that the show tried to bring 50 years ago?
No, I don't think so. I think that the issues are quite relevant in today's world.
The issues are relevant, but I'm just saying the audience is not as tuned in as I think to that type of thing that as they used to be.
Well, yeah, I mean, it depends on how you look at it, and you do have a point there. I think that the Twilight Zone, there's something about it that it talks up to the audience instead of down to it. So even young kids who are used to seeing a lot of things of today can flip through the sci-fi channel and catch a couple of episodes of The Twilight Zone and still be really impressed with the shocking endings that they're not really all that used to seeing in today's storytelling. So I think that it does still attract an audience.
And the other thing, you brought up the fact that it is Rod Serling himself, the man behind this, who made it such a success. Because the fact that it had a shocking twist ending most of the time is something that, in the hands of somebody else, could have been seen as a gimmick.
Yeah, I think so. It's kind of like, and not to put down someone specifically, but when M. Night Shyamalan's first Sixth Sense movie came out, it worked rather well. The ending and that story was very intriguing. And when that ending hit you, it was just like kablam, just like a Twilight Zone ending. Now, his following films, in my opinion, just critically speaking, you would always say, okay, well, what's the twist ending going to be? Because this guy always does these twist endings now. He's trying to be a Rod Serling. And sometimes you could actually guess the endings to them. So good point. I think Rod Serling, quite a genius. I think he was quite ingenious and a futurist and a humanitarian, a lot of things.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the site, which is now, as I mentioned, 10 years old. It's, as I said earlier, the number one internet site for Twilight Zone fans, and it's called the Twilight Zone Archives. And also, you've written a book called Dimensions Behind the Twilight Zone. Tell us about the success of those two entities.
Well, I think a combination of the book and the website, I think I've done my share of promoting the work of Rod Serling. The website started in 1999, and it's grown to be, like you've mentioned, a very noticeable website. It has your episode guides and all these kinds of things and information on Rod Serling, but it has a lot of unique sections to the site that like an exhibit almost. That has these rare photographs I have behind the scenes, which some of which are featured in the book. It has very rare documents. It has items that were Rod Serling's, background props, and it's the closest thing behind the scenes. The normal websites for Twilight Zone are basic episode guides and things like this. So The Twilight Zone Archives is quite unique. The book Dimensions Behind the Twilight Zone, I worked on for a number of years, and basically I have this collection of close to 4,500 images, these original production photographs that are very rare, that were shot during the actual filming of the Twilight Zone, of the original series Twilight Zone. And so the book features a number of about 350 of these photographs, and then there's also five chapters, analytical and historically informative, and then close to 40 interviews with alumni that worked on the series, so, you know, writers and directors and producers and a whole bunch of actors, and then a dozen appreciation essays by some creators of today's Hollywood who were influenced in some way by Rod Serling. Dimensions Behind the Twilight Zone, the book, and it's likely the closest thing you can get to behind-the-scenes feeling of you were there.
Rod Serling, of course, is no longer with us. Hasn't been for quite some time, but I believe his widow has been around for a while. Did you have a chance to talk to anybody connected to Rod personally, like his family, and do they have thoughts on your website and your book?
I met with Carol Serling early on when I was working on the book, and had shown her some photos from the collection, and she was blown away because these things had never been published before. She didn't even realize they were in existence. I also interviewed her for the book, and she has some very nice things to say about Rod and things that haven't really been talked about in other books, biographies and whatnot. And she's a grand lady. She's kept the candle lit all these years, and her interview is very candid. I also interviewed Robert Serling, who is Rod Serling's older brother, who also was a writer. I think he's just published his 30th book. And his interview was quite enlightening on, you know, Rod Serling, the man. And between both of those interviews, they kind of give you a good background look, I think, into Rod Serling.
And you mentioned you had an opportunity to talk to people who worked on the show, both behind the scenes and also as actors. I understand you spoke to people like Dennis Weaver, Bill Mumy, Cliff Robertson, and the like. Was there a common thread, besides the fact that they all worked on the show, was there something that they said that was common to all of them in working on an episode of The Twilight Zone?
Well, everyone had grand things, of course, to say about Rod Serling. The actors in particular talked about how working on the Twilight Zone was a must, and whenever their agents would come in with a script from the Twilight Zone or word that Rod Serling wanted him on the show, they would jump at the chance. Everyone said yes, of course, regardless if, you know, it was a nice starring role or, of course, co-starring role or an under three or whatever. Every actor jumped at the chance to be on the show because, again, at the time, most of television was quite mundane and not really very creative, very predictable. And The Twilight Zone was so different. It was nice to talk with a lot of the directors. I think I interviewed five or six directors, and it was great to hear their points of view on Rod Serling, the man. He, just talking about how energetic he was and how he wasn't always there when they were shooting, but he would always come down for his narrations, his on-screen narrations. During the seasons 2 through 5. And everyone just had very good positive things to say about Rod Serling. They said that he was way ahead of his time. I think that Richard Donner, the director Richard Donner, who has directed tons of movies in today's world, he commented that you kind of got the feeling that the cigarettes Rod Serling was smoking was something else because he was just so outside of the box. The guy was such a nonconformist. And, of course, everyone did also comment about how much cigarettes he smoked, which, again, killed him in the end.
Right. The website is twilightzone.org. People can check that out. The number one Twilight Zone website on the net, twilightzone.org. The book is called Dimensions Behind the Twilight Zone. The book is, of course, written by and the website hosted by Stuart Stanyard. And Stuart, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Of course, Peter. Well, thanks very much for having me on your show. And October, like we mentioned, October 2nd of last month marked the 50th anniversary. And all I can say is here's to the next 50 years. Cheers.
Stuart Stanyard, creator of the Twilight Zone Archives, the Internet's number one Twilight Zone website, and also the author of Dimensions Behind the Twilight Zone. Again, you'll find the website at twilightzone.org, and you'll find links to it on my website. As for the book, you can also find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can buy the book directly right on the Stuff File page on my website at peteranthonyholder.com. Just find the corresponding number for this show, which of course is 0012 if you're paying attention, and you'll find all that information. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, also heard on CyberStationUSA.com. Time now for a segment from Andrew Vizakis, the Night Sky Guy.
Now, the Stuff File presents Andrew Vizakis, the Night Sky Guy. It's radio that's out of this world.
Pegasus is one of the more ancient constellations representing the winged horse of Greek mythology, and today is a celestial landmark for autumn stargazers. To track it down yourself, simply face the southeastern evening skies all November long. Known as the Great Square of Pegasus, the chest of the horse is marked out by four stars forming a giant square standing on its corner. Lying roughly halfway, just outside the line between the top and right corner stars, is a very ordinary looking star called 51 Pegasi. On October 6, 1995, this faint, ordinary looking star took center stage with the incredible announcement that something was tugging on it. Not a star, but a planet. This was the first alien planet discovered orbiting a sun-like star. About half the mass of Jupiter, this gas giant orbits so close to his parent sun that its year lasts only about 4 days. Try your hand at hunting down this historical star with the naked eye or maybe using binoculars from your backyard. Either way, it's amazing to think that this twin of the sun, over 55 light years out, marks the home of a strange alien world. For more stargazing news, visit me online at thenightskyguy.com. I'm Andrew Fizakis. Until next time, clear skies.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that puts a smile on your face and a skip in your step. Please avoid skipping if you are driving.
And still to come on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, now heard on CyberStationUSA.com. We'll talk accents, we'll check the mailbag, we'll touch base with Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation, and we have an idiot of the day. But right now, one more Stuff File story before we get to our next guest. We go to Wellington, New Zealand for this story. A sculpture of a New Zealand government minister crafted from cow manure sold for $3,080 on an auction website. The bust of New Zealand Environment Minister Nick Smith, sculpted as a protest by artist Sam Mahan, attracted 112 bids before being picked up by an anonymous bidder on Friday. Mahan said he created the sculpture and chose the medium to protest what he considers Smith's too soft stance on pollution created by dairy farms. He said the bust did not smell and would last forever. Oh, lovely. He went on to say the sculpture has a hollow head, which is very fitting. It is highly polished and sits on the stand slightly to the right of center. Mahan gathered cow dung from an organic dairy farm, ground it into a coffee grinder. Remind me never to have coffee at this guy's house. Mixed it with a polymer resin and pressed it into a mold. He polished the sculpture with beeswax to create a finish that resembles bronze. Smith joked about the tribute on Friday. He said, "Excuse the pun, but I would describe it as crap art." Mahan said he will use the proceeds from the auction to clean up waterways polluted by the waste material of the dairy farms near his home. Okay, on to our next guest on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, which can now be heard on CyberStationUSA.com. Our next guest joins us via the wonderful technology that is Skype to Skype communication. An actress in England is in the business of slanging accents. Odile Rault has just launched UseMyAccent.com, where regular folks can upload their authentic accents for actors to study. Hi, Odile. How are you?
Hello there, Peter. Yes, I'm well. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. So tell us about how you started this and how it's working out.
Well, I'm an actress myself. I'm a professional actress. And the idea occurred to me when I was, I needed to shoot a showreel from scratch for my CV, for my online CV. And I needed to use an accent. And there were a couple of words in the script that I couldn't remember. I couldn't remember hearing someone with that accent say those words recently. And so I wasn't sure of them. And I thought, if only I could get someone with that accent to read it on, read the script onto a tape for me, you know, onto a recording, so I could check that. And when I realized I'd be quite prepared to pay someone to do that, I thought, oh, hang on a minute, there's something in that. Maybe others would be as well. And that's really how the idea came to me. Yeah.
So how long has the site been active?
It's literally only just started. The official launch date is actually only the 16th of November, but it is up and running and people are starting to join. So it's really very new still.
So how exactly is it used, and how do people get involved if they want to either supply accents or are looking for accents?
Well, if they go to the web, to www.usemyaccent.com, they can join as either a reader or an actor or both, if you know, because a lot of actors are putting their own accents on as well. And it's free to join. And for readers, once they get on there, there are step-by-step instructions of how to upload a sample of their accent. So they can just read a few lines or just say hi, you know, say a few things about themselves onto a recording, which will go on their profile. Then when an actor comes along looking for a specific accent, they can search the site by country, by the accent's country, and if they want to, they can actually search for a specific region of that country, you know, regional accents. When they do that, all members, all readers with that accent will come up, and the actor can then go and listen to each one's sample and choose the voice that they prefer.
So I'm guessing, since this is just starting now, that you don't have a complete catalog or library of accents. What are you looking for right now?
Everything. We're actually we've so far the press release went out on Monday, so it's only been a couple of days, and we have 43 members so far, and we are desperately looking for all accents. There are a lot, you know, we've got one or two of a few different ones, but we've got quite a few UK ones, quite a few English ones, and a couple of Americans. We've got no Canadians, and we've and we've got one Spanish, one Italian, one French, so one Polish. So it's a few South Africans. So really, we're looking for just about everything, because of, also it'll be nice to have a bit of choice for actors, so they can choose a voice, whether it's male or female, age, whatever voice timbre they prefer.
Now for continuity, are you asking people to read similar passages? Are you giving people similar things to do? Or the people who are supplying the voices for you, they just either talk or read or do whatever it is they want for people to ascertain their accent?
Yeah, for their sample, they can do whatever they like. You know, they can either just chat a little bit. A lot of them sort of just chat and introduce themselves, or they can read a nursery rhyme, or you know, anything that they like. Just for the actor to be able to hear the type of voice they have.
Now I'm listening to your accent, which obviously is is British. I can't necessarily.
Actually, not.
Sorry, what?
It's actually not, no.
What
well,
is it?
It's a mix, actually, with quite a bit of South African thrown in.
Okay, because what I was going to say is your accent is very reminiscent of Julie Andrews.
Oh, really? Oh, well, thank you.
Yes.
I appreciate that.
In the way you form your words, so I was just wondering if it was anything to do with maybe a similar part of England that she might be from.
Well, I sort of... I aspire, let's say, I aspire to her accent, because Julie Andrews' accent is what we call RP, which stands for Received Pronunciation, which is sort of well-spoken English, sort of upper-class English. And as an actress, that's, you know, that's a good accent to sort of have as a standard. So I'm very pleased you think I've got that one.
There are a lot of actors who come from across the pond and also from Australia to North America. I find it very interesting that Brits and Australians seem to be able to mask their accents very well, more so than sometimes people going the other way.
Okay. I think the American accent is quite easy to fall into because it's sort of it's comfortable and I find it very easy to fall into. I lived in America and Canadian as well. I don't want to leave you out. I mean the R's and the relaxed sort of way of speaking. I know that it's very a lot of people have trouble not picking it up when they go over to your side of the of the world, whereas I think the other way around it's quite difficult to probably form the it's more clipped. The English sound is more clipped and probably more hard work, really.
You say it's relatively easy for you to do an American accent. Can I hear some of your American?
Well, now, when I say that, and as I said it, I thought, oh, hold on a second. I think what I wanted to add to that is that it's easy to fall into an American accent, but there are certain words that people certain traps people fall into. For example, they'll say adult. An English or South African or whatever would say adult instead of adult.
Right.
So there's certain words that you wouldn't know, if you're saying, oh, do an American accent. So you pronounce all the words that you would normally pronounce with the same rhythm and emphasis. So the emphasis, we put it on the first part of the word adult. We say adult. But we put a twang to it and think, well, that's American. But it's only if you've heard Americans say the word adult that you realize it's adult, and they put the emphasis on the second part of the word.
Now, there are some vocal coaches out there. As you say, people are out there making money doing this. Are you hearing from vocal coaches, and are they upset in whatever accent they want to speak in with you?
I haven't heard them. No, I haven't heard from anyone yet. And this is certainly not to replace vocal coaches. Not many jobbing actors are able to afford a vocal coach for every, role they audition for or to do, even for roles they get. And I think that this site is more as an addition to whatever normal whatever current methods actors are using. So because it's a real person using their genuine native accent, and it's that person is reading the exact lines that the actor will be using, and I think that's the extra benefit of this.
Well, I know the acting community is usually very generous in helping one another, and there are actors out there who listen to this program, so I would encourage them, regardless of what part of the world they live in, to check out the website, which is usemyaccent.com, because I'm sure they'd be interested in helping you to make this thrive, because it's probably something they could take advantage of down the road themselves.
Absolutely. And a lot of actors, as I say, are putting their own accents on the site as well. So, they can, as well as ordinary people. So,
the website, again, is usemyaccent.com. I thank you very much, Odile, for talking with us on the program.
Thank you, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
Odile Rault and her website, usemyaccent.com. You can also find the link by going to my website, peteranthonyholder.com, and clicking on the Stuff File podcast button for this show, which is 0012. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Now heard on cyberstationusa.com. Time to check the mailbag.
Incoming subspace signal.
And we have just one item I want to get to in the Stuff File mailbag on this edition of the Stuff File program. This one comes from Rob, and it was sent to us via Facebook. Rob made reference to a story that I shared in the Stuff File three shows ago, back in 0009. It was a story, if you remember, about a guy from Springfield, Virginia, by the name of Eric Williamson, who was arrested for walking around naked in his own home at 5 a.m. when he was going to the kitchen to make a cup of coffee He was arrested because some woman outside his house managed to see him, and as a result, he could face a year in jail and a $2,000 fine. Anyway, Rob wrote and said, "Loved episode number 9. For the number of times I've made coffee naked, I'd be serving a 20-year sentence consecutively." Well, thanks for the visual, Rob, and as the old commercial says, good to the last drop. You know, this has turned into such a big story that I've put a link in the mailbag section on the Stuff File program page, the page for this show, which is 0002, that shows a television news piece that was done on this story, if you want to take a look at it. After seeing it, I'm now even more on this poor guy's side. Eric is a commercial diver who grew up in Hawaii. Clearly, he's quite comfortable in his own skin. Having naked coffee in your own house shouldn't be a crime. Having naked coffee at Dunkin' Donuts, that's another story. Anyway, check out the link to the story. You can see it on my website at the Stuff File program page for this show, 0002. And that's the mailbag. This is the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. The program also heard on CyberStationUSA.com. Back in a moment.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, Peter Anthony Holder once again brings you Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. Lock up your daughters, and in West Virginia, your sheep. Joining Peter Anthony Holder is our intrepid embedded reporter, deep in the heartland of the U.S. of A., Stephen S. Walsh.
How you doing, Steve Areno?
Hey, I'm adequate.
You know how to quit what?
No, I'm adequate.
Oh, you're adequate. Oh, okay.
Yes, I'm adequate.
Oh,
I'm not about to quit. I am adequate.
Oh, okay.
Adequate.
Okay.
I'm doing okay.
Oh, okay.
I'm feeling happy and cheerful and all the rest of those wonderful things that we get into each and every week right here on this very show.
There you go. Boy, you're
giddy. Boy.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, I know it's fall. It's fall in Missouri. The temperature, we had rain for so many days. People when they went to the football games, they had to park their canoes and swim. I mean, it was terrible. It was terrible, okay? I use canoe because I know Canadians love canoes.
There you go. There you go.
That's what I hear anyway.
Plus
there's
a Lewis and Clark reference.
Oh, yes, you got to have the Lewis and Clark reference, you know, because this is Missouri. And remember, we were part of the Louisiana Purchase.
I remember. Not that I was there. But
well, Napoleon had to pay for his wars, so we bought it for $15 million. What a bargain.
Exactly.
Of course, we got New Orleans as part of that package. I guess that wasn't much of a bargain, but what the heck?
Ouch.
Ouch. Come on.
In any case, sir. Sir.
Tough place.
Yes.
Jeez.
Sir.
Yeah.
What do you have?
Yes, yes, sir. Are we going to talk today now? Or
yeah.
What
do you have for us?
What do I have for you? I have nothing. I'm just going to sit and listen to you.
Okay.
Which I do every week anyway. Okay, seriously. Let me clear my throat a second, shall I?
Yep.
Okay. Dateline, Springfield, Missouri.
That'll be the show me state.
It's Roy Olivia now.
Yes, I know.
A woman from Springfield who claimed she needed a monkey to help with her disability has had her lawsuit thrown out of federal court.
If I had a nickel.
You know, we don't even have to continue, and already it's funny, but we'll go on anyway.
Yeah.
Debbie Rose, nickname Axel, no, seriously. Debbie Rose sued the Springfield Greene County Health Department, Cox Health, and Springfield Walmart after they refused to let her bring the monkey inside local restaurants and businesses. Rose says she suffered from an anxiety disorder since the 1970s and needed the animal to calm her. The judge ruled the monkey was not a service animal and that Rose was not disabled.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, there were two monkeys, actually, and one of them was named Thorn. The other one, no. The Rose between them. Okay. Seriously.
Yeah.
Imagine a monkey. What is it with monkeys? What is it with... Imagine someone trying to bring a monkey into the store. I mean, seriously.
Hmm.
Let's move on.
Let's.
Dateline, Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, no, Ohio. I can't believe can hardly wait to say goodbye.
That'd be the Buckeye State.
I used to live there, you know.
I know.
In Columbus and Ohio.
I know.
Police say an Ohio woman being driven around in a limousine announced at a coat store that she'd won the lottery and would pay for everyone's purchases, but ended up causing a riot when customers realized it was a hoax. Columbus Police Lieutenant Michael Deakins, now that for folks in Canada, lieutenant is lieutenant, even though there's no F in lieutenant, says the woman announced that she'd spend $500 on everyone at a Burlington coat factory, prompting customers to gather at registers and call relatives. When police arrived, 500 people filled the store and another 1,000 were outside. Cashiers rang up sales before discovering the woman had no money. Angry customers grabbed clothing without paying for it. The limo driver turned the woman in. Police say she was arrested on 3 outstanding warrants but was not charged for the coat store chaos, pending a mental health evaluation.
You know, I think this says more about the maddening throng than it says about her, to be honest. First of all, these people these people were gullible enough to believe it. And then when they realized it was a hoax, they went on mob mentality, mob rules, basically.
I know, and they wanted this is again, I come to the Roman satirist Juvenus, bread and circuses. The mob wanted its handouts free.
There you go.
Dateline, Sheboygan, Wisconsin.
Ah, that'd be the Badger State.
Or as we like to call it,
the Cheese State.
Where the motto is,
if it's cheddar,
it's better. 36-year-old Julia E. Locke was accused of stealing a bag of beef jerky and a lighter from a convenience store. So police went to her home to investigate. At first, she refused to come to the door and allegedly began screaming and swearing at 3 children in her house, telling one that the incident was all his fault. Sounds like my mom. Anyway, police eventually entered and tried to calm her down. But with her children present, she then stripped down to her underwear and told the officers they couldn't arrest her because she would be naked. Well, that turned out not to be true, and as officers tried to arrest her, she allegedly kicked one of them in the groin and spit in the mouth of another. Gee, sounds like something you'd see on a baseball diamond. Anyway, while in the squad car on the way to the police station, Locke reportedly exposed her buttocks against the rear window. Ah, yes, pressed ham time. Turns out she had a blood alcohol level of 0.112%. Are we surprised? Of course not. That's well over the legal limit. She was charged with felony battery of a peace officer, resisting an officer, shoplifting, and 2 counts of disorderly conduct.
Mother of the year.
Well, I think others of that ilk have been nominated before.
Or maybe even a longer word.
Yes, I know. You know, it's not necessarily a hyphenated word.
I know.
Dateline. Somewhere in Minnesota, we'll call it St. Paul.
Okay, that's the Gopher State.
Yeah, the Gopher State up in Minnesota, land of 10,000 lakes, some of them call it.
Yep.
You know, Governor Kim Pawlenty of Minnesota has not only ordered the removal of 2 dozen 50-inch flat-screen TVs from a Moose Lake sex offender treatment program, but also criticized what he called the bonehead decision to buy them in the first place. Pawlenty said, "We don't micromanage our agencies at the level of every little item that they purchase or use, but in this case, we're going to micromanage it. I think it was a boneheaded decision." That's quite a comment, isn't it? The Minnesota Sex Offender Program at Moose Lake is one of, I love that name, Moose Lake. It's one of 2 state facilities that house civilly committed sex offenders who are deemed such a danger that they are held beyond their normal prison sentences. There are 365 sex offenders currently at Moose Lake, one for every day of the year. The State Department of Human Services bought 25 50-inch plasma screen TVs for the facility's common areas. But now, they're gone.
This is one time when I actually have to agree with the governor in this one.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think it's pretty clear. Yeah.
And you said 365 sex offenders, one for every day of the year?
Yes.
There's a calendar I don't want to see.
Yeah, I know. Well, gee, you know, having these sex offenders in a place called Moose Lake, that's something I don't want to see.
Yeah.
Dateline, Des Moines, Iowa.
That'd be the Hawkeye State.
They have long legs, you know.
The Hawkeye State?
Moose.
Oh, okay.
Simon Saw, as opposed to Simon Says, Simon Saw had a commanding lead entering the final stretch of the Des Moines Marathon when he was held up by a passing train. That's when the runner in second place caught up. Then the runner in third caught up. With just a quarter mile left, the lead runners came up against a train crossing the road. By the time it passed, almost a minute later, the pack was set for a sprint to the finish. Saw ended up winning anyway. But, you know, he might have had quite a controversy if he hadn't won. I mean, so who's to blame, right? The train apparently was operated by Iowa Interstate Railroad. Tom Bernow, the president of the company that puts on the marathon, produced an email thread from September 15th showing race director Chris Birch had detailed the course map and the marathon dates to the railroad. Mick Burkhard, the vice president of the Iowa Interstate Railroad, responded to Birch that this should not be a problem. Burkhard responded in an email after the race that his company was indeed at fault. Do you know what the problem was, Peter?
What's that?
The marathoners didn't properly train for this event.
Well, you know what?
What?
My hat's off to, what is it, Mick Burkhard? Is this the guy's name?
Yes, yes.
My hat's off to him because he actually said, you know,
we blew it.
He admitted a mistake. That you don't see that often. And you know, the fact that he can admit a mistake, it's great to see. Most people in public life don't admit mistakes, and that just makes people mad.
Oh, it gets me angry. And when that happens, you know, when I get angry, I, of course, I'm like most people, I write a 2-minute tirade.
Yes.
And I do so by taking keyboard in hand.
Yes.
And I was angry at something earlier, so I did take keyboard in hand and wrote a 2-minute tirade. Would you like me to go on with my 2-minute tirade for tonight?
Tirade away.
Well, it's time for my 2-minute tirade, Peter. And right now, I got to tell you, I want to go after these people with tinted windows in their cars. What really peeves me is that it's these people, or so it seems, who are the ones who honk at you when they see you on the street or when they see you getting into your car. They beep, you look at them, can't see who's beeping, and ignore the people. They, of course, can see you, and they're too stupid to realize that you cannot see them. So, the next time they see you, they give you a really rough time because they beeped at you when they saw you walking along the street, but you were rude and didn't return the wave. Of course we didn't return the wave. Do you think I just wave at people I don't know or can't see? Of course not. So I think it's time to really call out these boobs. Look, I don't really understand why you feel the need to hide behind tinted glass. It's kind of stupid if you ask me. But if you are that insecure, fine. But must you honk the horn at other people? Here's a suggestion. Lose the tinted glass and get something that allows me to see in just as you can see out. If we don't have a two-way street, hey, it just doesn't work. And one other thing. Once you get the new glass and you see me and you give me a toot on the horn, don't expect me to wave at you. If you were too stupid to have see-through plate glass in the first place, why would I want to wave at you, you jerk?
Whoa. Yes. I noticed something, by the way, in this particular
What would that
tirade.
Be, Peter?
Some certain terms and phrases you've used. Tinted windows. You said these people. And you said honk. Is this some sort of Appalachian code that I'm missing?
Code? Code? what do you mean code?
I'm just asking.
Whatever could you mean by that?
Nothing in particular. I'm asking you.
Next thing you know, I'll be calling Barack Obama a socialist.
On that note, sir.
Have you heard that latest?
I've heard a lot.
some clown apparently claims that calling anyone who's black a socialist is racist.
Yeah.
You call a white guy a socialist, but you can't call a black person a socialist.
Hey, I'm in Canada. What can I say?
Point taken.
Say
you
those
socialists up there.
Thank you. Say those three magic words.
Hit the thief!
This is the Stuff File.
And we're just about done with this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We have time for one more story, and that, of course, would be the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
Well, it was a rookie mistake, but a big one. A novice pilot was doing aerobatic maneuvers when he accidentally pulled on the black and yellow emergency handle between his legs. That's not the emergency brake. Nope. That's the ejector lever, and our boy suddenly found himself shooting 100 meters into the air by the plane's rocket-powered emergency chair. This all went down near Cape Town, South Africa, and authorities have not released the pilot's name, but they did say he's lucky to be alive. The lever is fitted as standard in the Pilatus PC-7 MK2 jets to allow pilots and their passengers to eject from the aircraft in the event of an emergency. The pilot floated down to Earth on a parachute which opened automatically. Why would he pull the handle that I'm sure in his training he would know as the ejector seat? Because he's an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A program now heard on CyberStationUSA.com. That's CyberStationUSA.com. Go there, click on it, bookmark it, save it. My website is PeterAnthonyHolder.com, where you'll find information and links on our guests by going to the Stuff File program page. Just look for the corresponding date and program number. In this case, it's 0012. That's 0012. You can email me at peter@peteranthonyholder.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter. At Facebook, it's facebook.com/paholder, and at Twitter, it's twitter.com/paholder. That's it for me, Peter Anthony Holder. I'll see you back here next time on the Stuff File program. Same bat time, same bat channel, including cyberstationusa.com. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.